In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast, fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. 100 years ago, in 1924, Ramsay MacDonald became Britain's first ever Labour Prime Minister. So how did MacDonald drive the party to power? And what challenges did he face once he got there? In conversation with Spencer Mizzen, David Torrance, the author of Wild Men, The Remarkable Story of Britain's First Labour Government, tells a tale of working class ministers, a terrified establishment, and fake Bolshevik plots.
Hi, David. Thank you very much for joining us today. So, your new book is called The Wild Men, The Remarkable Story of Britain's First Labour Government. So, my first question is, who are the wild men to whom the title refers, and why were they described as such?
So the wild men are members of the First Labour Government. So they're ministers, they're MPs. Some of them are members of the House of Lords. But the wild men was a pejorative term, a sort of smear, if you like, used by political opponents, so mainly Conservatives at the time, but also by the media, the Daily Mail, for example. And the implication, of course, was that they were some sort of extremists, wild left-wingers. And the context for this is that the Russian Revolution of 1917 is still pretty fresh in the public memory. So what political opponents and what sections of the media were attempting to do was equate the Labour Party of the United Kingdom with what the public knew of left-wingers in other parts of the world.
So this January marked the centenary of Ramsay MacDonald becoming Britain's first Labour Prime Minister, but before looking at the events of 100 years ago in a bit more detail, can you set them in context for us, please? How long had the Labour Party existed when MacDonald entered Number 10? And how unlikely would his ascent of power have appeared, say, 10 years before that?
Yeah, so good questions. It was a very young party. The Labour Representation Committee, as it was originally clunkily called, had only come into being in 1906. It quickly becomes the Labour Party. Ramsay MacDonald and others are chairman of the party, or what we would now call leaders. But yeah, it looked pretty unlikely. Only in 1922 had Labour become the main opposition party, but they were far behind the Conservatives at that point. You know, they were not seen as within touching distance of government. And indeed, senior Labour figures at around that time are looking at voting figures, and they're plotting on a graph and trying to predict when they might reach office. And I think that the sort of soonest date they come up with is 1926 or 1927. So, yeah, when the election happens in December 1923, I think Labour are upbeat, but they certainly, even themselves, do not have a realistic expectation of forming a government.
So what were the reasons for its rise to power? I mean, what impact did, for example, the passing of the 1918 Representation of the People Act have in propelling the Labour Party towards Downing Street?
Actually, quite minimal. This is the difficulty with this period. It's quite confusing. We are conditioned to think that elections happen, a party wins the election, and the party which wins forms a government. That didn't really happen in 1923, so it takes a bit of unpicking. 1918 and the extension of the franchise was important. More working class people could vote. Women, of course, not all women, but many women could vote. And that did alter the complexion of the electorate. But the Labour Party in that election did all right, but not amazingly well. They emerged with 191 MPs, so fewer than a third. And remember, at this point, the House of Commons has got quite a bit smaller because a lot of Irish MPs have just left because of the formation of the Free State. But the Conservatives are still the largest single party by quite some margin, but they have lost their majority. And the Liberal Party, which has just reunified, the Lloyd George and Asquith factions, have actually done okay as well. So the way it plays out is this. The obvious solution to this inconclusive result is for the Conservatives to form a coalition with the Liberals. However, a previous Conservative-Liberal coalition, a Liberal-led coalition, had broken up in quite bitter circumstances in 1922, and so neither party could countenance a return to that. And therefore, constitutional convention dictated that the King sent for the person, the individual, who was next best placed to command the confidence of the House of Commons. And that was the leader of the opposition. That was Ramsay MacDonald. But as I say, he had 191 MPs. So he wasn't just a minority government. You know, he wasn't even the single largest party. So it was a bit of an accident. Labour didn't win that election. The Conservatives didn't win it. Well, no one really won the election. And just a series of quite interesting events led to that point. And crucial was the position of Asquith, H.H. Asquith, who's leading the Liberals. He makes a speech at the National Liberal Club in mid-December, so a couple of weeks after the election, in which he says, basically, I will not support Stanley Baldwin in office when he faces Parliament in January, but I will support Labour. Basically, my party will give them a chance to show they can govern. And in a crucial line, he says, the experiment of a Labour government, which would have come sooner or later, cannot be tried in safer circumstances. A line which, interestingly, infuriates Ramsay MacDonald, because he sees it as quite condescending. He sees this as Asquith somehow implying that he will still be in charge, that he will still be sort of guiding the affairs of government from the opposition benches.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to keep you connected and moving together as one.
So McDonald's entry to number 10 comes as a bit of a surprise to a lot of people, including, it sounds, to McDonald himself and much of the Labour Party. How ready for government were they, given the speed with which these events had unfolded?
Not really ready at all. As I say, even on their own optimistic planning, they were not going to get within touching distance of office until a few years later. So they have to quickly decide a number of things, not least whether they will accept office. And that was not a given. Just a couple of days after the election, Ramsay MacDonald is sort of consulting with senior colleagues. A couple are saying, don't do it. You know, the government will crash and burn. It will be so weak. It will damage Labour and our prospects. But the mainstream majority view from senior leadership figures is we need to do this, because if we do not, we will look as if we're scared of taking office. You know, our pretensions to being a party of government will look threadbare, and we'll end up skulking on the opposition benches in the Commons while our opponents, you know, point and laugh. So MacDonald was quite clear in his mind that they had no choice but to accept. And his planning and thinking then quickly turned to, how on earth am I going to form a government? MacDonald was actually quite rude about the quality of his own MPs. He felt he had very little to play with. He also had to bring in different factions of the Labour Party, and it's an incredibly complicated parliamentary party and movement at this point. Not only that, he feels to legitimise this government, given its weak position, that he needs to bring in Liberals. And so he goes searching for quite progressive but quite aristocratic Liberal figures to prop up the government. And in my favourite twist, he even recruits a couple of Conservatives.
As you point out in the introduction to your book, as well as the Liberals and the Conservatives you just mentioned now, this new government was also made up of former publicans, miners, railwaymen and ironmongers. These weren't the type of people that typically operated the levers of power in Britain. I mean, what did the establishment make of this new breed of working class men entering government? Was there some tensions there?
And not a bit of bemusement. I mean, if you look at diaries and letters from the period, sort of the normal governing classes, Liberals and Tories, are, some of them are alarmed, but actually most of them, I think, realise that actually, you know, Ramsay MacDonald is a reasonable human being. So whatever the politics of it, they don't think that they're crazy and incapable. They don't think the government will last very long, not because they're working class, but because it lacks sufficient support and the circumstances are not quite right. But actually, Ramsay MacDonald has a degree of kudos, even amongst critics and opponents, because he is a very impressive figure. He's a charismatic performer. He has huge experience of world affairs. He's travelled widely. He knows all the key players in Europe and around the world. So he is a credible figure. But at the same time, it was a huge novelty to find Jimmy Thomas, for example, the leader of the railway union, becoming colonial secretary, Philip Snowden, the sort of rather austere Yorkshireman, becoming chancellor. Interestingly, Snowden, he has a disability. He's had a childhood illness, which means he walks with great difficulty with the aid of a couple of sticks. So he is the first disabled, I think, chancellor of the Exchequer, which has sort of been ignored by history. Yeah, as I say, it's treated as a novelty, but not without a degree of seriousness. There is a sense broadly that they are to be given a chance. It's a sort of British sense of fair play in a way. These are how the cards have fallen. Labour have formed a government. Let's see what they can do.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, the Russian Revolution cast a little bit of a shadow over this episode, and there was a degree of fear among some elements of the establishment and the wider nation as to what would happen next. I mean, did some people genuinely worry that under a Labour government, a Russian-style revolution may be coming to Britain?
Yeah, so I mentioned Philip Snowden, the first Chancellor. He recounts in his memoirs having to assure an aristocratic lady that her head wouldn't be cut off, or failing that, her earnings or her savings wouldn't be confiscated. So there was a genuine fear, and that fear was stoked by the Daily Mail in particular, and some opponents. And the King George V, was very apprehensive. I did a lot of research in the excellent Royal Archives at Windsor, and it's quite clear that he is very wary of a Labour government, not least because his cousin, the Tsar, had been murdered just a few years before in Russia. And indeed, the day that Ramsay MacDonald kisses hands as Prime Minister, and the King, knowing that the Labour Party is preparing to formally recognise the Soviet Union for the first time, says to his new Prime Minister, "Please do not make me shake hands with an ambassador, a representative of the people who murdered my cousin." So that really illustrates the fear, almost the disgust that certain figures in the establishment had for Russia and for potential relations between the UK and that country.
And how did relations between MacDonald and the King evolve over the following months?
Very well. That's another interesting point. I think at this time, the Labour Party is not sort of naturally monarchist, and the King is certainly not inclined towards the Labour Party. But they very quickly develop quite an interesting rapport. Ramsay MacDonald goes out of his way, as do senior Labour figures, to reassure the King and his advisers that they are not going to do anything extreme. They realise that they don't have the support, public or parliamentary, for that. And the King quickly realises in quite an agile way that, you know, a Labour government was going to happen sooner or later. As a constitutional monarch, he needs to be above the fray. But that's the interesting thing. We take for granted now, I think, especially after the long reign of Queen Elizabeth II, that monarchs don't interfere in a party political sense. Not as much the case at this point. Indeed, the political views of George V himself were quite well known. But this is the point at which I think the monarchy evolves into that much more politically neutral institution, and they both legitimise one another. It becomes a mutually beneficial relationship. The King obviously wants to be seen as above the fray, a sort of father of the nation figure, this benign constitutional monarch. And similarly, the Labour Party wants to be seen as respectable and responsible, and for its leader, the Prime Minister, to enjoy convivial relations with the King Emperor is one way of demonstrating that.
And what kind of challenges did being in government present the Labour Party in terms of unity? I mean, from reading your book, it seems that MacDonald spent quite a lot of his time basically trying to keep the party, the different parts of the party, together, and it wasn't always unified. I mean, why was that?
Basically, there were tensions within. As I said at the start, some in the Labour Party didn't think they should accept office. They didn't think they were ready. They thought that they would be forced to compromise, to sort of moderate their socialist credentials. Whereas MacDonald's view was very much, we have to do this, and not only do we have to do it, we have to demonstrate that we're moderate and respectable. The left, and when I say the left, you had Clydesiders from the west of Scotland. These were the independent Labour Party, which at this time is affiliated to the Labour Party, but separate. And also in Poplar in East London, quite a radical left-wing contingent. And they, although they signed up initially, they quickly became disillusioned. They felt that the government wasn't really delivering on its promises, that they weren't really satisfying the desires of their natural supporters on the left. MacDonald, conscious of this, has recruited John Wheatley, who's a leading ILP MP, to be Minister of Health and Housing in the cabinet. And that's his way of saying, you know, look, guys, you're integral to this project. Don't cause me too much trouble. But during the life of the government, the tensions increase. And it's largely because the government lacks the two things that most governments have, which is a parliamentary majority and therefore control of the legislative agenda. They were not in a position where they could introduce a bill and safely see it onto the statute book. They basically had to face every division on its own terms, build support amongst Liberals and even Conservatives. And for those on the left of the Labour Party, they were deeply uncomfortable about that. They did not want to cut deals with Liberals and Conservatives because they felt that was diminishing, that was eroding their central message and their central ethos.
What kind of country was Britain 100 years ago? I mean, what were the main challenges facing Donald's administration as they entered number 10 in January 1924?
The UK has undergone huge recent changes. Most of Ireland has just become independent, so the House of Commons has reduced in size. Northern Ireland has been granted what we would now call devolution. There's a devolved Parliament of Northern Ireland. It has its own Prime Minister and government. The Church in Wales has recently been disestablished. And of course, the First World War, the Great War, as it was called, is still a recent memory. And the British economy, its trading prospects, unemployment levels have all been hugely impacted by that. So there's a real sense that it's a nation in flux, and there will be three elections in as many years. Ramsay MacDonald is the fourth prime minister in the space of 2 years. Lloyd George had led the coalition. Bonar Law has a very brief premiership. Stanley Baldwin, of course, and then MacDonald. So politics at this time is hugely unstable, and the first Labour government is very much part of that feeling of huge change and political flux.
So do you think any government would have struggled to have lasted more than a few months at this point?
Any government with 191 MPs, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was fewer than a third of the members of the House of Commons. And also, you have to remember the House of Lords. Labour simply didn't have any peers. The House of Lords at this point, of course, is a predominantly hereditary body, and hereditary earls and viscounts were not Labour supporters. So one of the things Ramsay MacDonald had to do right at the start was create hereditary peers, three or four, merely to serve as ministers. But he was quite uncomfortable doing that. So he deliberately chose people who didn't have children, who didn't have heirs. And that was him sort of making the point that I don't want to sort of propagate this system. So yeah, any government would have struggled with that. And of course, the Labour Party had very limited governing experience. A few of the ministers in this government had served during the First World War coalition. Arthur Henderson, for example, who became Home Secretary in 1924, did have experience of government, but it was very, very limited.
Okay, so they're only in government, as it turned out, for barely 10 months. What would you say were their greatest achievements in that short period of time?
The most commonly acknowledged achievement is in housing. John Wheatley was Minister for Health. He had responsibility for housing. He basically creates what we would call council housing as it became. He finally gets the construction industry and the trade unions together to agree a massive house building programme backed by state subsidies. So that achievement has been generally acknowledged. I would add to that foreign affairs. So Ramsay MacDonald is Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary. He has huge experience in that realm. He basically gets a revision to the Versailles Treaty, under which Germany is paying quite crippling reparations to France. There's a new settlement in that respect. The French troops move out of the Ruhr Valley, which they've occupied because of this tensions. And so in August 1924, there's a general view that Ramsay MacDonald has helped create what he called a new atmosphere in European relations. Germany and France have finally started speaking to one another for the first time since the First World War. Ramsay MacDonald also addresses the League of Nations, which is the United Nations of its day in Geneva. He's the first British Prime Minister to do that. He is seen as having a great command of the world stage of foreign affairs. And importantly, and usefully from his point of view, that didn't need parliamentary approval. foreign affairs then as now, or to a lesser degree now, was conducted under the royal prerogative and didn't need parliamentary approval. And given that he only had 191 MPs, that, of course, was very useful.
So what's the most surprising thing that you discovered during the course of your research? Is there anything that really sticks in your mind as a bit of a, well, I didn't expect to read that?
Yeah, so on the point of the King's apprehension about the Labour government, towards the end of 1923, there's sort of assurances going in both directions about what this would mean. But there's a sense that both are unconvinced by each other's soothing noises. And I think it's New Year's Day, 1924, Jimmy Thomas, who is about to become colonial secretary, basically bangs on the door of the King's private secretary at Windsor and demands to know if the King is concerned about the formation of a Labour government. And Lord Stamfordham, who later recounts all of this to the King, of course, is quite taken aback and says, well, he can't say anything other than, of course, that's not true. The King is very comfortable with the idea of a Labour government, which was not true at that point. So that I found really interesting because, you know, 100 years later, that simply wouldn't happen. The idea that a monarch now would be jittery about a left-wing government or a right-wing government or any sort of government, it just wouldn't happen. So that correspondence, those memos at Windsor capture the fragility of that moment, I guess. It was not a given that Labour would enter office. It was not a given that Labour would be moderate in office. It was not a given that politics as it had existed would carry on as normal.
Okay, so how important would you say the Zinoviev letter was in the eventual demise of this administration?
So Zinoviev is probably the most comprehensively recorded aspect of the first Labour government. There's been books, there's been documentaries, it's been well raked over the years. I think it's an exaggeration, as others have concluded, to say that that lost Labour the election. It seems unlikely that Labour would have won the October 1924 election. However, the Zinoviev letter, an early example of fake news, if you like, did exacerbate a movement towards the Conservatives at that time. And although the Labour government, I think, was seen to have done quite well, middle-class voters and indeed newly enfranchised female voters at this time did sort of respond to Conservative messaging on, you know, the danger posed by communists and Labour people in a way which pushed them towards the Conservatives. So that trend was underway. The Zinoviev letter is published by the Daily Mail 4 days out from polling day, and it chimes beautifully and destructively with the central message of the Conservative campaign, which is these people might say they're moderates, that they're responsible, but actually they're taking commands from the Communist Party of Great Britain, from Moscow, and if they get a majority, they will do really dangerous things. You know, they've not been able to do that because they're a minority. But if you vote for more of these people, you better worry. And that has a huge impact. So it doesn't lose them the election, but I think it does contribute to the size of the Conservative landslide.
So was it in some cases for some voters pushing in an open door, would you say? They had these suspicions festering. It kind of confirm those suspicions.
I think that's right. And that is why a lot of people are very suspicious about that letter, because it was, the timing was just a bit too neat. Its contents was just a bit too convenient.
Sorry, just for listeners who won't be overly familiar of what the letter alleged, can you just give us a really brief run through of that, please?
So Zinoviev was a sort of senior revolutionary Russian figure. He was a bit of a Bolshevist bogeyman for the press at that time, and indeed his name crops up throughout 1924. It's a letter from him in Moscow to the Communist Party of Great Britain, who were not aligned with the Labour Party, but there was a general view that the Labour Party was influenced by communists. And the letter was basically inciting the labour movement to rise up and revolt, you know, to echo the Russian Revolution of 1917. So that was obviously an incredibly embarrassing thing to appear for the Labour Party at a sensitive time.
What were the other main factors that contributed to the fall of this first Labour administration?
So By August 24, there's a general sense that the government's doing quite well. And I think that politicians from every party detect on the ground that support is growing for Labour. The Liberals are spooked by this because they still see themselves as a party of government. The Conservatives by this point have regrouped, they've refreshed their agenda after that surprise election the previous year. So basically the Liberals and the Conservatives decide to bring down the government. They think that the experiment, as some of them call it, has run its course. The pretext is a loan to the Soviet Union. This is part of trade treaties which MacDonald and others have been negotiating. It's part of the recognition of the Soviet Union, an attempt to normalise relations. The idea of lending money to people who are seen as having blood on their hands from 1917 is too much for some Liberals and Tories. But in reality, it's just a pretext to get rid of the government. There's a motion of no confidence that's lost. MacDonald asks the King to dissolve Parliament for the third time in as many years, and an election ensues. But here's the point. Despite that, despite the impact of the Zinoviev letter, and despite the fact Labour loses 40 or 50 seats in that election, they gain 1 million votes. So by that broader measurement, the government is not defeated. It has actually increased its support. 1 million more people have given a vote of confidence in the Labour Party as a party of government.
So given what you've just said, I mean, do you think history is treated that first Labour government and also the figure of Ramsay MacDonald a little bit unfairly?
Not just a little bit, hugely unfairly. And the trouble is that the events of 1931, you know, which in a nutshell, Ramsay MacDonald agreeing to head a national government which mainly comprised Tories, this was called the Great Betrayal by Labour figures, that has blotted out the sun, and it's been sort of backdated to 1924, and it cancels out the achievements of that first government. MacDonald himself was just ostracised by his party and historians. And it's only in 1977, the year I was born, that someone, David Marquand, writes a broadly sympathetic account of Ramsay MacDonald, in which he makes the point, with which I concur, that MacDonald was operating in hugely challenging circumstances and had to take difficult decisions. And it's unfair to judge those decisions from the vantage point of now, or indeed even from 1931. It was down to MacDonald that first Labour government entered office at all, that it cohered, that it survived for as long as it did. He had huge political skills, also faults, very sensitive figure. He didn't handle the Zinoviev letter well and other aspects of that administration. But there's a reason he returns to government in 1929. There's a reason that he serves as prime minister until the mid-1930s. And there's a reason that he was seen as a very capable foreign secretary. He was a huge figure. And the fact that he's so little known today, I think, is quite striking.
And did the Attlee government learn anything from MacDonald's administration in the mid-1920s?
Yeah, it did. Attlee's very interesting. Attlee was a junior minister in 1924, so he had a ringside seat. Although he did grow disillusioned with MacDonald and that Labour government later on, he wrote later in 1937 quite a vivid summary of the impact of that government. He said he perfectly understood the Labour Party wanting to demonstrate the utility of being in office. As Attlee says, voters don't understand things they cannot see. So the mere fact of experiencing a Labour government at that point legitimised it. It made it a party of government. And following the election of October 1924, you have a two-party system that shifts from Liberal and Conservatives to Conservatives and Labour. And therefore, without that first Labour government, you could not have had the majority government led by Clement Attlee in 1945.
And finally, David, how much of what you encountered in 1924 reminds you of Britain today? I mean, are there many similarities between today's political landscape and that of the early to mid-1920s?
I say in the book that when I started the research, I was a bit concerned I'd discover a faraway country of which I understood very little. Actually, a lot of it seemed extremely familiar, not only the sort of tensions within the Labour Party and movement, but also the domestic scene, the challenge of a fragile economy, the border in Northern Ireland was an issue in 1924. Scotland was demanding home rule. There was a shortage of affordable housing. Foreign affairs was very turbulent. It simply served to confirm that there is nothing new under the sun.
That was David Torrens. His book, Wild Men, The Remarkable Story of Britain's First Labour Government, is published by Bloomsbury. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Sam Leal Green.